It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. The fight over how to get more Georgians covered by health insurance entered a new phase yesterday when the Georgia Chamber of Commerce released its highly anticipated report, actually three possible plans for the state to consider as possible compromises with the federal government. Now, the state has refused to expand its Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Blake Fullenweider is one of those behind the proposal. He's an independent consultant to the chamber. Also joining us, Brian Robinson, whom you normally hear on our political breakfast with Theron Johnson. This time, Brian is here as a spokesperson for the task force that put this whole thing together. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Dennis. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Mr. Fullenweider, I'll start with you. The assumption behind all this is that Georgia is somehow unique, needs its own solution. Specifically, what is unique about Georgia's coverage challenges that couldn't be addressed by just expanding under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think every state is a little bit unique, and Georgia is no different from that. In fact, you've seen a number of states across the country that have looked to mold the policy in a way that best fits the needs of their state, not some blanket type of solution that the Affordable Care Act proposed.
But what does Georgia have that's different or couldn't be accomplished by expanding under the Affordable Care Act?
I think what you'll see in the alternatives that the task force has put forward is a strong emphasis on employment, on moving people from welfare into work, and becoming more self-sustaining and self-sufficient on their own merit.
But isn't that something every state has to deal with? So why is Georgia somehow different here?
I won't say that we're different. I think that our approach to dealing with the issue may be different. In fact, you're going to see across the other states that have looked at this issue, Georgia is going to lead in terms of being the most sustainable, most affordable, and most conservative alternative that's been put out so far. So we're hoping to change the paradigm of the discussion and to move into a situation where we're looking for a solution that fits Georgia, that's uniquely Georgia, that doesn't follow the dictates of the Affordable Care Act.
You said it emphasizes employment, and people hearing that are going to say, well, is there an assumption here that folks who are struggling to pay their health coverage aren't also looking for work? I mean, isn't everybody looking for work anyway?
Right, and I think there's a delicate balance that can be reached there. You know, one of the things that we want to emphasize is the value of employer-sponsored coverage and putting people into coverage that they get through their employment or through the exchange, and not creating Medicaid. While we intend it to be a on-ramp for people to move into better economic standing, we don't want it to be a place where people fall and they stay. And so you'll see a strong focus on employer-sponsored insurance and other private coverage solutions that are available.
And I think adding on to that, we have a responsibility when spending tax dollars, and in this case, state taxpayer dollars are at stake, to tell them that your money is going to be used efficiently and wisely and conservatively. We owe that to the people who are paying the bill.
But you already have employers who are dropping coverage on their own for people. How do you incentivize employers?
Well, that's not for the states. Mm-hmm. Policy to determine. That's going to be something that has to be determined on the federal level. And that's going to be the answer to a lot of these issues. You know, people who raise questions to me and Blake, often what they're complaining about are federal regulations and federal laws, not state policy. And the state here is focusing on what it can control.
Senate Health and Human Services Committee Chairman Renee Unterman, who's a Republican, told me earlier this year the state can no longer afford to just say no to some form of expanded coverage. And here's part of what she had to say.
Unfortunately, we're in the midst of the firestorm, and we can't turn back the hands of time. The Affordable Care Act is here, and that's why I'm willing to look at a waiver, because the hands of time are not going to be turned back, and we're not going to go back to a fee-for-service. You can't flip back time.
Do you agree with her that the state can no longer just say no?
Yes. She's absolutely right. We're already paying a state share today, and that's the point that she's making, is that folks who think that we're getting a free ride by not following the dictates of the Affordable Care Act, even in a waiver manner, are wrong. The state is having to backfill a lot of the losses. You know, Georgia employers under the Federal Affordable Care Act have already gotten up to $1 billion in cuts, according to the Georgia Hospital Association. That's because the Affordable Care Act has significant cuts to Medicare and Medicaid because of the assumption that everyone's going to be covered. Well, in Georgia, they're not all covered. So our providers, those who we depend on when we are sick, when we have a disease, when we have an emergency, you know, they are getting all of the sticks and none of the candy that is in this law. You know, we're taking the cuts but not getting the new money. That's the reality. That's what on the state level we don't have the power to change, but we do have the power to change our policy to make sure that we get our money back and inject billions of dollars into our economy from the federal government. Now, Georgians are sending their tax dollars to Washington, and they're going to other states. They're going to California, New York, and Illinois. They're not coming back home. This would be billions of dollars injected into our health care system and then indirectly into our economy. And that would make a tremendous difference on both of those factors.
Let's take a look at the menu that the chamber has proposed here. Mr. Fullenweider, I'll start with you. Without getting too much into the weeds here, because that's easy to do, the chamber proposal has these three options with different eligibility standards for coverage depending on a patient's income. That's the yardstick that's used. And the most restrictive one would only cover people whose incomes are at or below the poverty line. So only cover people who are making $11,700 or so or less. Isn't the big problem with uninsured Georgians, though, those who are just above the poverty line but who still can't afford coverage?
Well, the reason why we're considering this alternative is because due to the Supreme Court decision that made Medicaid expansion an option for the states, those that are left below 100% of federal poverty level are really left with no viable option to get coverage if they don't get it through their employer. That most of the time they can't afford it. And they, if they don't have access through their employer, they just can't get it. The exchanges or the marketplace plans, the subsidies begin at 100% and go from 100 to 400% of the federal poverty level. And to put that in perspective, as you said, around 100% FPL is roughly $11,700.
FPL is federal poverty line or whatever you want to call it.
Correct.
Federal poverty limit. Yeah.
That's right. And when you take that at 100% up to 400%, when you look at a family of four, that's a household income of roughly $92,000 or $93,000 a year. So there are a large number of people who fall within the federal subsidy range that can get those subsidies to buy coverage on the exchange today. So the option one that deals with the eligibility group only up to 100% truly seeks to deal specifically with the coverage gap. We're not dealing with those from 100 to 138%. The other two options do include...
They cover more people.
And
they cover people with higher incomes up to around 16,000 plus or
for,
so.
For an individual, yes.
For an individual,
right.
Okay.
Right. So we've kept that on the table as well. It was originally envisioned by the ACA to cover individuals up to 138% of the federal poverty level. The Obama administration has been very clear to states that it is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. We recognize, as we have gone through this process and prepare for the discussion with state leadership, the legislature, and others, under any circumstance, we're going to be dealing with a different administration in Washington, D.C. And this is an issue that may change. And if so, we want to be prepared and know what our options are.
But Washington has said every time another state has tried to limit coverage just to people at that 11,700 and below mark, no, you can't do that. We're not going to give you a waiver for that. So why even include that in this plan?
Well, again, we're going to be dealing with a different administration, and these are the types of things that can change. And I think as you look at other states, particularly southeastern states that are alongside Georgia and rejecting the ACA, this may be one of those issues that the administration would be willing to compromise on.
Brian, I'll turn to you with the political side of this. Isn't there a risk, though, that if the legislature says, oh, boy, there's the restrictive one, let's go for that, that the administration will say no and we've lost more time, have to go back to square one, come up with a new plan, and in the meantime, we're losing federal reimbursement money, which is the problem to start with?
this is a long-term proposition. I think getting it right and making sure that those who write our budgets in the General Assembly and in the governor's office know that Georgia can afford what we're doing long-term. It's no good to anybody if it's not sustainable and if it's not fiscally responsible. We don't just have one plan. We have three plans. And so this could go
multiple
tracks.
But the legislature only passed one.
Well, we could submit a waiver and negotiate, and we go from there. That is how this works. You negotiate with the administration. We set out to meet the dictate set forth by the people elected by the voters in Georgia. Those officials wanted something that was conservative, that was less expensive than what we're seeing in traditional states around the country, and was therefore more sustainable. They want to make sure that we don't have a, you know, this squeezed balloon that pops on the back end in the 2020s. You know, we need to look toward the future. These plans are more sustainable, they're more affordable, and they're conservative.
Mr. Fullenweider, let me come back to a point you made, which deals with the people who are above the poverty line of $11,700 but make $16,000 or so or less and might be covered under some of your options but not on that one. If they are left out, if the state chooses the more restrictive option, are you saying that those folks could afford health insurance elsewhere?
I wouldn't say that they're left out. In fact, they are covered under the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Mm-hmm. And as Brian mentioned, you know, as a state, we've got to be able to deal with the issues that we can deal with as a state. That is a federal issue. We have a federal exchange. If affordability is an issue in those plans, it's going to be up to Congress and up to the administration to fix those problems.
Whatever administration we might have.
Right.
One of the assumptions that the state has made, and Mr. Fullenweider, I'll start with you, is that okay, the ACA is a non-starter. Obamacare is a non-starter. But let's assume for a moment that that political resistance was not there. From a coverage and financial point of view, is expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act actually the best solution the state has, even though it's a political non-starter here?
It all hinges on affordability and sustainability. That is the key issue with Medicaid expansion. If the state can't afford it, you have no program. What we've tried to do is to come up with alternatives to the traditional expansion that meet those requirements, and we feel like we've done that.
What we're looking to do is to cover as many people as possible, to make sure that people showing up at the emergency room or at the doctor's office are paying customers so that we can keep our healthcare network alive and do it in a way that is as cost-effective for the state as possible. And putting in elements of personal responsibility, making sure beneficiaries have skin in the game, emphasizing as a program delivery system reform and welfare to work, those are going to be things that set us apart. And when people are sick and can't get to the doctor, they also can't get a job. When people can't go to the doctor, they don't get preventive care, and then they show up in the emergency room with much more expensive problems. It doesn't matter if you're a liberal or if you're a conservative, Republican, or Democrat. We can all accept that those facts are true. We can disagree on how the best way to get there is. But there are a limited set of options available to us as a state to address it. What we have done is looked at those options and carved out a Georgia way that is conservative, sustainable, responsible, and covers hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who don't have it today.
You have both talked about cost effectiveness and sustainability, but Mr. Fullenweider, there are no cost estimates for any of the options in the plan that you have released. So how much is it going to cost, and how do we know it's sustainable?
Let's let Brian take that one.
we have done a deep dive on eligibility, the number of people that we expect to come on to the rolls, and estimates on what each of the three options would cost in state dollars and how much it would draw down in federal dollars. Now, obviously, as you go from option one to two to three, you're going to draw down much more federal dollars with each one. That's the trade-off. The less we spend, the less money we draw down. The more we spend, the more money we draw down.
That is the more restrictive you are, the less the feds are going to give you.
That's right. And those are decisions that the General Assembly will undertake as they consider this debate. But that's why we gave them three options. so that they will be able to determine what they think is best for the state. It is their decision. We're going to have these debates, these discussions with legislators, the governor, stakeholders in the industry over the next few months, getting ready for the big game when the session starts in January. That's when the decisions will be made, hopefully.
Have you talked to your former boss, the governor, to find out what he thinks about this?
Well,
because he has said no expansion of Medicaid.
Well, the governor has said, and I'm not—
So we can't afford it.
The governor has said numerous things. One of the things he has said is that I'm open to looking at options that are affordable and sustainable. It was his words that molded how we approached this. He set those guidelines in his public comments. This is not something he said in private meetings right. with me and Blake. Blake's also a former governor staffer, too. Those were the guidelines he gave, and that was our mandate as we looked for a solution.
Mr. Fullenwater, Georgia has one of the highest rates of uninsured in the nation. We're, I guess, 48th, or if you want to put it that way, say the third highest rate of uninsured in the country. Any estimate of how many people the plan would cover to bring that rate down?
Well, depending on the options that you select, we estimate anywhere in year one for option one, for instance, to cover about 565,000 Georgians. If you pick option—
Out of about how many uninsured do you think?
I don't have that number right off the top of my head.
And for the option two and option three, that'll be, as well as cost estimates and economic impact, those are all numbers that we're going to release moving forward. The one that Blake just gave, the 500 number, is one we discussed back in June, July with some healthcare industry media. But the total package will roll out, and as part of a conversation with the people of Georgia over the next few months, we wanted to get the conversation started today with legislators and public officials. And as we move on and there's a level of understanding about what we're working on, we'll roll out more information that we've collected over the last year.
I want to come back to one of the details of the plan. There are cost-sharing measures in there, as you have pointed out, including premiums and co-pays. So would people who fall under the poverty line, 11,700 plus or less, have to pay those too? And would anybody be able to afford them?
That's going to be part of a negotiation with CMS. What we've envisioned and what we've
and
laid
CMS
out—
is?
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington. Okay. What we've laid out in our vision is that everyone receiving coverage will have some skin in the game. So it may be a very minimal premium, whatever the Medicaid rules will allow.
So you might work out some sort of sliding scale?
Correct.
To be approved by the feds?
That's right.
And how would you know what people can actually afford? Because part of the problem for a lot of folks are deductibles and co-pays.
Right. Well, that again is part of a negotiation and looking at affordability. In any respect, the affordability limits for this population are set in law, and it's up to 2% of household income is the maximum. That's combined with a premium. That's combined with any other out-of-pocket cost sharing. So whatever rules or premiums that we may put into place, they have to meet those rules in the very beginning because that's federal law.
In Indiana, those cost-saving measures have taken some heat, really, because of the idea of having people maintain their coverage through monthly contributions, kind of like a health savings account. Does that create barriers to people keeping their coverage as it goes along?
We want to incentivize people to be invested in their own health. And again, I think it's important to step back and look at the population who we're talking about. We're talking about largely childless adults, some very low-income parents, that are working age and work able. And part of what we are seeking to accomplish from a policy perspective is to provide this as an on-ramp into self-sustaining coverage, whether it's through an employer or through the marketplace, for instance.
How does it do that? How does it get people into that affordable, independent coverage realm?
I use the term healthcare fluency, and it's being literate with how the commercial healthcare system works. And anybody in commercial coverage has to make a monthly premium contribution. And so as part of getting people familiar with the way the system works for time down the road when they're able to move into employer coverage, that's part of the design that we're seeking to promote.
Obviously, one of the big drivers for this is the crisis in the state's rural health care system, the rural hospitals. Mr. Fullenwider, can you project through any of these options that more people would be able to afford coverage, that hospitals would get reimbursements greater than they have now because of perhaps the federal money that might the state might get, and that either hospitals could avoid closing or even maybe some of those who are closed reopen in some form?
Right, and I think this would go a long way into shoring up the rural health care infrastructure in our state. As you mentioned, it's been in a precarious state for many years now. Turning no-pay customers into paying customers can go a long way. And when you look at the proportion of Medicaid enrollees geographically across the state, there is a large concentration of Medicaid and no-pay consumers in rural Georgia. And so bringing that element into the mix can go a long way to stabilize the infrastructure across the state.
There's a bigger overarching question, which is that critics of Obamacare point out that it hasn't done everything it intended to do. And defenders of Obamacare say, well, the system was broken before, and we've at least made some steps toward fixing it. But is the system broken beyond the point where Georgia, in the kind of plan you're talking about, or the feds in terms of Obamacare, or whatever anybody has come up with so far, isn't really going to address all of the problems we have?
It's really broad.
I know. It's an overarching. But, I mean, that's the fear, I think, that a lot of people right. have, is that the system is broken beyond the ability of anybody anywhere in the political system to fix it.
Sure. I think that is an ongoing national debate. It's something that was in Chris Clark's quote in the release that went out yesterday, saying people can have a debate on what's happening in Washington and have a debate on the proper role of the federal government or any government in health care delivery. But on the state level, for those who are elected to represent us in the governor's office and in the state Senate and the state House of Representatives, we're not having that debate in a way that affects policy. We have to deal with reality as it is. We have to deal with the law as it is, not as we wish it to be. And under the law, we are taking a beating under the present system. We're taking cuts.
Have we waited too long to do this? In other
words, absolutely not.
We're caught between a rock and a hard place. Even if we make an agreement with the federal government now, we're at a point in the life of the Affordable Care Act where we're going to be drawing down less than we would have if we had done something earlier. Meanwhile, our costs are going up. So are we caught in a double whammy here because we waited too long?
That's not how we can approach this. That does us no good to see it that way. We've got to approach this as finding a solution to a problem moving forward. We're not alone. There are still a little less than 20 states that haven't done this, but it's shrinking every day. The number of who hasn't done it is going down, and you're seeing totally red states, Utah, Wyoming, the Dakotas, looking at their own expansion plans, and I believe one of the Dakotas has already expanded. So you're seeing completely Republican-controlled legislatures and governors trying to find a solution under the federal law. And we're sort of in the same boat here, too.
Mr. Fullenwider, from a policy point of view, not from a political point of view here, what if the state does nothing?
I think you're going to continue to see rural infrastructure struggle to maintain itself. You'll see contracting continue across the state. Also think you'll see the demands on large safety net centers like Grady here in Atlanta or Memorial down in Savannah continue to struggle with the impact of uncompensated care. Employers across the state will continue to subsidize uncompensated care through premiums for their employees, and the employees themselves will continue to pay for it in their monthly contribution. So it will continue, I think, to be a burden on everyone in Georgia, either way things play out.
One obvious question is why the Georgia Chamber? Why is the business community addressing this issue? And one, the people of Georgia are the employees of Georgia, so it affects business directly having access to health care. But from an economic development standpoint, which is something the Chamber and the Department of Economic Development and the county departments of economic development all focus on, if we have a region that loses its hospital or hospitals, getting a major employer who provides high-paying jobs to a skilled workforce becomes impossible. There's no one who's going to come to a region where their employees and their executives, the ones making the decision about where to go, are going to go if they don't have a hospital and extensive healthcare network there on the ground. Two, even if you have insurance, this issue affects you. You are not immune because you have insurance. As Blake said earlier, if you are paying premiums in Georgia, you're already paying for the uninsured. You are making up the gap for what the folks who show up without any money or any insurance don't pay. But having insurance does you no good if you are in an area that has lost its nearest hospital. If you have a stroke, a heart attack, if you are pregnant and go into labor, having that hospital nearby is of crucial importance. And if it's not, your insurance does you no good.
It's a bit of a technical question, but if you're submitting a plan which covers folks above the poverty line, 16,000 plus, and the feds already have that in place, why do you need a waiver for that?
We need a waiver because it all depends on how the program is designed. And what we are seeking to do is to move away from a 1965 statutory design and into a system that works for the 21st century. And that's what these waivers allow us to do. It looks at the delivery system. It looks at delivery system reform. And coupled with that, as well as providing coverage for this population, we're able to do a lot of things that the antiquated law just won't allow.
So you're saying that even though you're meeting the overall income parameters of the federal law, the mechanisms are different, and that's why you need a waiver.
That's exactly right.
Brian, you're the former political operative here. Let me just ask you the political question. In a legislature which is going to be majority Republican no matter how the election comes out,
yes,
in a legislature where many people have already staked part of their political lives on saying absolutely not to expanding Medicaid, absolutely not to Obamacare, what are the chances that this plan, even though it comes from a business group, would get through?
The debate has changed dramatically in the last 6 years from hell no to how. And that's happened because much of the Republican caucus in both houses represents rural areas of the state. This isn't theoretical to them. This is not an ideological debate. They are seeing their constituency lose access to health care, jobs, and major parts of their tax base. This is a very real day-to-day issue for the people they are sent to Atlanta to represent. That has changed the debate. Two, the cuts have taken effect in the last 6 years. Before, it wasn't in theory. Today, we've had $1 billion in cuts in Medicare to Georgia providers, and they're supposed to just make that up out of thin air. That's not sustainable. They've got to find a solution. Three, we need to educate the people of Georgia on the problem and how our solution is sustainable and fiscally responsible. And that's part of what we're trying to do over the next few months leading up to session.
Mr. Fullenwater, one more question for you. The makeup of the task force, since everyone from people making a lot of money and running businesses to people who are making practically no money are affected by all of this, how diverse was the task force itself? I mean, it is a business group proposing the solution, but did you hear all of the voices from the different parts of Georgia?
The makeup of the task force was incredibly diverse and large. We had over 30 stakeholders at the table from the healthcare sector, from the business community, as you said, from the consumer advocate groups, all at the table. Diverse interests, but one of the key themes that I was so impressed by was the unification of the voice behind looking for solutions. And that was from day one, was a theme that carried out through our entire process, looking for solutions, and that's what we've sought to do.
Blake Fullenweider is an independent consultant to the Georgia Chamber of Commerce, which has just released its three possible plans for getting more Georgians covered by health insurance. Brian Robinson, of course, familiar from our political breakfast with Theron Johnson, is appearing here as a spokesperson for that task force. Thanks to both of you. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you.